You're listening to Time Lost, a poetry podcast by Perdu, Center for Poetry and Experimentation in Amsterdam. We invite authors to undust a work that has gone unpublished or was unpublishable in the first place. Every episode, you'll be hearing a work that is now being granted a second chance.
Hello, my name is Ollie Patterson, and in this episode of Time Lost, we are joined by Will Alexander, who I'm very, very excited to have on the show today, all the way from California. Will, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. It's an absolute pleasure. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me and inviting me to the episode.
No problem. I've very much enjoyed the pre-conversations, you know, before this.
So. Oh, they were very, very fertile, very, very, very beautiful, you know, acclimatizing, beautiful.
Yeah, no, definitely. We've covered a lot so far, but I feel like we've still got endless amounts of things to talk about. So it's very excited.
Fabulous.
Nice. So I guess what I wanted to start talking about, first of all, just quickly, just I'm assuming that this piece is unpublished rather than unpublishable.
Yeah, it's not in the world yet.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering where does this work sit in your oeuvre, and how did you come to this essay, or perhaps how did it come to you?
Well, it's been a long, interesting ride. The origin of this mind span I've been working with came to me beginning of 2019. I was thinking about just rummaging around for thoughts, you know, and I was in Portland, Oregon. I was doing some work in the university up there. And I was rummaging around in my mind during some, I would say, off time. And I was looking for another way into reality, to use my writing as a way of exploration, just like a possible astronaut or a scuba diver would work. But I went into the zone where I was looking for something for the mind to get through to some other level of the mystery that we're all in. And the mind began to rummage into this, I wouldn't say rummage, but circulate and begin to move into this kind of what I would call an audio or kind of an aural darkness, exploration of aural darkness. And this led to my understanding of the anterior or what anterior means in terms of cosmic pre-creation. We always hear about the Big Bang, you know, and what happened after the Big Bang. But what about where the mind breaks down, or the anterior of the Big Bang in the mind? And this is incredible darkness. So you marry that, or you combine that, or connect that. You try to connect that with how lingual exploration works. And for me, it wasn't just mingling things in this world, but trying to hear things like you would possibly hear in a clarified oneric state, where you're just coming on things that are outside of the normal senses. And I was able to begin to plow my way through the darkness in a certain way. And it was almost like going against the grain as I was writing. Reality was not given to me. I was exploring this incredible diamond mind in the spirit. And it was like amazing, because it wasn't like coming to me like, how could I say, it wasn't like coming to me from a script from the visible world or the accessible world, but it was coming from another level of awareness, much deeper down. It's like you don't have the access that you would with, you know, you're playing with the senses. You're not playing with any of the senses. And so I began to just explore this and go by word as it came to me. That's how I work, you know, as things come to me, not like I'm engineering anything or making a cognitive statement about what I know. But when you're exploring, you're not looking with prior grammar. And in my case, it was like probing through the darkness. I was feeling like my mind was feeling like I was going through the darkness. But as I began to exercise with that kind of consciousness, words began to slowly accrete and became palpable in terms of script, and I was writing them down. And the book itself, from which this project started, was called Anterior Wattage, about the wattage that transpired before possible Big Bang, and which led me to other possibilities of Aboriginal techniques, non-Western techniques, but not in that sense, but in the sense that it was in terms of another kind of praxis that I can't properly describe right now, but it was more like an indigenous search, magical search for language, not based on just some prior Occidental school of the surrealist. It was more about inner exploration that I was concerned for. And I am concerned for now, not in an ideological sense, but as a search. Language is a search for being. And this search for being is extremely crucial. It should be crucial to all of us. For me, this search for being is more like is lingually for me, because that's the only real skill I have. I can't take a microscope and search for being. But it's like the, or a telescope as such. But what I can do is lingually explore. It gets back to the conversations we had earlier about the Egyptian methods of going into your own trance to the point where you begin to open up the whole energy field and enlighten. It's called enlightenment in certain cultures, on all cultures. But the way that I was doing it, I'm doing enlightenment is more like a personal kind of movement via language into this darkness. And this is what you find in the old schools of Luxor, you know, where you weren't given, by the way, Luxor is a Greek appellation, but where the Egyptian scholar was given certain methods of exploration via his or her discipline, via geography or via writing or via medicine. But it was a learning of the self. And this is what I'm trying to do, is learning of the self via my lingual abilities. And this is the way that this book has unfolded, Anterior Wattage, which I'm kind of still working on. But the piece that I'm thinking about working on, talking about today, was just recently scripted. And I was thinking about putting these two pieces as part of Anterior Wattage. They felt like new works, really new works. And the mind is turning over at that rate. So this is like a piece I'm thinking about is like a working title that, you know, I've come up with. It's called Modern Mental Terrain, Procuring Script from Nauseous Diamonds. And I'll read the first couple sentences. The present human state has decoded itself as a state of nervous adjectives. Its collective neurology, a grinding circular labor mesmerized by occluded possibility simultaneous with carnivorous self-desolation. As we fail to access ourselves, inner promulgation seems suspended and our psychophysical kinetics remains haunted with its codes and rhythms of codes, attempting to match themselves, consisting of energies that perpetually spawn themselves with confusion. Therefore, the contemporary mind has reverted itself to self-rendered calculation, a living calculus of disability populous with confusion via protracted stalemate. Thus, we suffer via neo-astigmatism, though pervaded by the falsely distilled grammar, in part due to household technocracy. Because the spell of inner growth has been stymied by a robotic atmosphere of superimposed, traceable by coding of uploaded documents, it remains, in my view, a circumstance that William I. Robinson now contends has hurtled into global surveillance activity, a living state that protracts itself and self-sculpts itself, that simulates the manner in which ocean water remains simultaneous with the creatures that exist therein. The former remains a torturous connivance conveyed by a grammar that has extended its linearity into a superimposed surveillance that simultaneously encodes the walking corridors of Berlin, as well as those non-traceable scents that roil the density that remains the Amazon. Rather than understanding knowledge as it subtly shifts into strategies of itself, as it evinces protracted suffocation, I remain a curious outlier, void of its magnetic referent points, void of its classification. I remain dissolved of its grid, its patterns. As the late David Rattray once put it, I remain one of the invisibles, one of the uncounted who propagates ambiguity. By ceasing to propel corporate principles, I remain condoned by anonymity in anonymous self-exile, who stages his craft sans massive public witness, less probe than an ancient amphora.
Nice.
That's one small part. I don't know if that made an impact in terms of quantity or longevity, but what I'm tending towards doing is kind of working out my own philosophy. And as you know, this takes a lifetime of energy. And so it's after the combustion cycle, you know, after you do a big effort, it either wears you down or brings you new energy and new renewed energy, even when you feel innervated at a certain point. But I'm feeling the latter, you know, where I've been renewed to fully explore myself, more fully explore myself. So it's like I'm tending towards writing down my own philosophy at this point, rather than depending on outside sources to see if this is correct or that's correct, but just to put the energy out there so that one does not have to feel that one has to look over one's shoulder as to what's correct or incorrect. And so what I'm doing here at this stage is not worrying about mistakes or how someone else has done something or how they conceived of correct or not correct. I'm not dealing with that. As Booker said, I'm just dealing with the sound and how I can, you know, how that language can be balanced. Because, you know, language always has to be balanced. Always has to be balanced. And I learned that from how Miró, the painter, talked about balancing a picture. How you put things into elements. So in other words, in general, if you turn a drawing or painting any direction, it should be balanced. So I take that whole idea of balance into everything that I write. So in that sense, it has a primeval coherence, like nature has its primeval coherence.
Like a kind of golden ratio, or like a natural symmetry that kind of runs throughout it in some way.
A natural symmetry, not an imposed symmetry. A natural symmetry that I'm really understanding as I go forward and I develop. I call it an indigenous symmetry, where you don't impose symmetry on the scale of nature, but let nature take its course. And since I'm nature and I'm bringing this out, I'm not imposing a course on my own nature via what we consider to be education. But, you know, I'm fortunate in that degree that I found this for myself while I can still enact it.
Yeah. And do you think that this kind of, you're saying about a kind of philosophy that you're working through. Do you think that this is something that has come from your praxis? Is it something that has emanated from you working through this form for so long and honing this, you know, this love and this skill for a thing like poetry? Do you think this come from this, or is this something that you would have maybe, you know, gained or intuited otherwise as well?
From the former, you know, from the praxis itself. because you become familiar with your own praxis to such a degree that you can work with it.
Yeah.
You're not bringing a foreign element into your skills because someone else is, like Calder did, it's work with mobiles. But, you know, I'm not going to be working with mobiles. I'm working with things that allow me, that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, yeah.
As a being. And it's authentic too, because you feel it. And then you start to feel the innovation. You don't, it's not constricted from somebody's other psychological corridor.
Yeah.
It's not in other words, it's not an intellectual exercise.
I think the really interesting thing about your work is this kind of element of synecdoche, where it's like, it feels like every single sentence is a kind of hyper narrative in itself. I wonder what you think about this, maybe this idea, like Ron Silliman said it, and I think it definitely, not to kind of put you in, not to attribute you to any group, you know, like we were talking about yesterday, but I think this thing that he said, you know, kind of rings true with your work, is this idea of like the hyper narrative. It's sort of, you're pushing so many images and ideas into one line, condensing it or distilling it, you know, into this very pure state, into each line, that I feel like even reading out a piece kind of reflects the whole in some way, or at least if it's not the whole of the piece, it's the whole of yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I took this analogy from the basic idea of a teaspoon of a neutron star, that it weighs nice. So much. I mean, you can't fathom it. It's too much. But the teaspoon of a neutron star.
Yeah,
and that's
cool.
Each sentence, word, phrase for me, each actual syllable and phoneme, everything counts for me. Mm. All the balances count.
Yeah.
In other words, it's back to that balancing of a picture frame, you know, where every part counts. And there's there's no detritus. As I developed, I understood that there are certain energy links that you don't need articles, where the articles are thrown away, except when they're just absolutely necessary. It's like building the pyramids. You don't need any gaps in the construction.
Yeah.
So the tighter it gets, the more durable it gets. Mm. And it's no infiltration from the currents of the moment. So I'm not interested in the currents of the moment, because you can get away with things in the currents of the moment. But to get to the point where you have a construction that can last so many, you know, eons, like the pyramids, it's kind of like a mathematical grammar, a mathematical density that has endured. By the way, because they have a mathematical density of the mind, it's not like the modern mind. And you can't configure, say, even the constructions of the pyramids in terms of modern thinking. So, by the way, the Egyptians didn't require grades, like Dar el-Hukma didn't require grades. They were just like ways of opening the being, which is like a similar way of maturity that the Egyptians had.
It seems like a completely different rhetoric, and like a completely different metric and a completely different system than to what we see as valuable today, you know, instead of, you know, what you're talking about, which is the opening up of the self, and that obviously requires different things for different people. Now it's, you know, just like we were sort of saying yesterday, very rigid and very, can you learn how to remember rather than learn how to be in the world?
That's wonderfully put, to remember how to be in the world, not to go into the past and stamp quotes, which I've never been really able to do. I'm fortunate. I thought it was a deficit to go back and to quote somebody exactly how they put it. What about the manner in which I put things? So it remains medicinal for me.
Yeah.
And that therefore remains medicinal for others, because it's medicinal for me as I'm concurrent with the modern world.
Yeah.
But the point is to open up the neurology to nutrients. And there's part of the physiology called the anterior temporal lobe, where that opens up to abstraction naturally, where one is not, in other words, once one focuses on that area of the mind, other things begin to flow, kind of like the way that things flow in an oneric state, or in a dream state. It's a continuous meditative state. This is where my mind is working all the time. And I find that once one begins to explore that area, as Breton once said, you know, the words just come. This is how you do it. It's not from the outside in, but from the inside out. You know, the trees grow, flowers grow, things grow. And that's what I'm interested in, the experience of language, however crude or whatever it may be, I put it down, which is, it's analogous to automatic writing.
Yeah.
And for me, it's almost turned into what I'd call a supra writing. above the head, not below, but above.
Mm. And has that feeling changed for you? So like the more that you've entered this practice and you've worked through it, have you felt that beaming or that transmission move from somewhere in the thought processing part to somewhere above? Like, have you, obviously it's taken, you know, some time, but can you feel some almost kind of physical, visceral change or shift in the way that things emanate from you?
I do. Obviously, it's not ideological. I'm not casting a theory here, but it's an experience that I'm feeling. And I feel it in actual writing, because I'll have an idea about something I'm going to say. And then in almost a split second later, the energy turns around and it works.
Yeah.
It works. It's a living flow that's outside of the personal will, outside of personal willpower.
Mm.
And that's that anterior energy. It gets back into the whole idea of the anterior, where we didn't put anything here. It's something that's been put here. And as indigenous cultures love to recognize that, not just ideologically, but in a natural way, you know, the land, the water, the rivers.
Mm.
And the Occident has come in and taken that away from us, taken that energy away from our neurological, predilection.
Yeah.
And we become blocked and obsessive with coordinating, you know, suffocation. It's like all of the uranium, all of the mineral products that come, say, out of the Congo or out of Niger or any of these countries, populates the modern world, period. Not that simple, but it's been a lot of carnage along the way.
Yeah.
And it's disrupted everybody. I'm talking about us on planet Earth. We're not living up to our potential. And so I'm trying to work with another linguistic potential.
Yeah.
Maybe I might not be the best person to do it, but I'm doing it. I'm attempting to do it. So here we are.
Okay. So I think in terms of literature, I feel like we live in this time where a lot of poetry, the poetry landscape, is very self-reflexive and very kind of egoic. And I feel what is really refreshing about your work is that the I in your work is usually this kind of interconnected, intergalactic we, even if you are referring to yourself, you know, and you know, you're talking about yourself going on this journey to kind of liberate, you know, yourself and others. So what do you think about who is that I in this work? And is there a way, are you trying to shed a kind of sense of ego? Where does the I kind of sit?
Well, you beautifully put. I have to use the I. You have to use the I, but not in a way of certain limited cognition of ownership.
Mm.
I'm not trying to own the work as such. I'm trying to disseminate the work. And I have to say I because I'm a person. and this energy has to come through. It's coming through me. Not coming through someone else, but I say I because of that as a provisional aspect of putting the energy out into the world. Hmm. Not as a author as such, you know, like as a this author is set in stone and he can't be. In other words, there's no flexibility. In modern logic and modern thinking, modern education, because we just pointed out, it's a reflex back into limitation, into the psychological geography of stone.
Yeah.
And I think it's something I learned years ago, that Goethe said that the fall of the modern world, he understood it was involved with impulse. And it's something I gathered from John Singh's understanding of impulse with his play, The Playboy of the Western World, where he put this energy of impulse into this deadened village. and where it caused some kind of, I use the word kerfuffle amongst the locals. But the whole idea of energy, of impulse, is the most important thing, I think, rather than intellect. Because Tolstoy once said that the person that his favorite poet, I think it was Nekrasov, I think who was a stable boy, I may be mistaken on that. But in other words, what he was talking about was the basic impulse, not the educational skill of the, say, Nekrasov, but the energy and the sincerity of his lingual address. And this is what I'm interested in, is that sincerity of lingual address. I mean, there's tons of scholars, and I'm not diminishing anybody, but I don't have all of that architecture, so I just use what I can use. And hence we go forward. We try to go forward.
And it seems like the most kind of immediate, I don't know, for me, writing feels like, and especially your work, seems like the most sort of immediate way, most immediate form, you know, through which to express that kind of electrical impulse, you know, that we were sort of talking about.
Yeah, we're talking about electrical impulse. We're not talking about how many notes I can gather about my impulse. Mm. We mistake a lot of times a lot of those notes for real energy or real intelligence. And it is intelligent, but it's on a lesser scale. The poet, I think, is at the highest scale. And I'm not saying that because I'm a poet, because of that immediacy.
Yeah.
Because of immediacy. And a lot of people that are learned and they know this, they know that, they know this, they know that. It's great. But it's not at this at that level of absolute penetration of the being. It doesn't get into that level. It gets into the informational complex that it's, I would say, secondary, but it reaches back to what we've already known. But the poet is put into the unique position where he or she can explore directly. And how many things you can explore directly in this world where it's been so commodified?
Yeah.
When things begin to open up as they are in this period, I've noticed new things are being discovered. Like there's a whole cove of coelacanths. These are these ancient fish that supposedly had disappeared. And they discovered one, I think, in 1937. But they found out recently there's a new hive of them. And they've been supposedly extinct for way over 50 million years. So this is an interesting kind of era that we're entering into now. One of death and one of renewal.
Yeah.
One of questioning of certainty and entering into another era of uncertainty. But it is still, that uncertainty is still a momentum. It's impulse. It's life. Even though it seems shaky at first under the situations that we're going through, that we've gone through in a prior sense, you know, of stability and order and this and honor and this and that, this. But, you know, we're going into another kingdom there is of the mind. So I think the poet can explore that more succinctly and fortuitously than any other form at this time. And we're talking about an active flow of consciousness in the world now that can't be held back by prior ideologies.
Yeah.
I mean, people are giving it their best, but it's a wasted effort at this time. You have to go with energy, like you go with a grain of wood, you go with a grain, so therefore it works, the energy works for you rather than against you. And I think that's what Breton was talking about, the energy, you take language and let it work for you rather than you imposing it, your thoughts on it. By letting language open you, it doesn't destroy you. It makes you stronger and more flexible. Flexibility is the key. Flexibility is the key. If your mind is aged, then you're aged, whatever age you may be. But if the mind is clear and it's open, it's working, it's relevant. It's like water. You just don't dam it up in one space. It goes bad. But if it's flowing, it stays fresh. Yeah. All my lingual exercises and being exercises are about staying as fresh in the mind as possible. Even if I don't understand what I'm doing right at that moment, of the vocabulary, the grammar of that particular area of expertise, but I'm getting something out of it all the time, and I'm putting things together.
Yeah. So on that same kind of line of thought, what is your approach to sense making in that sense? Like Bernadette Mayer talks about sense making as being something that is sometimes inhibiting to our work, and I feel like, yeah, I was wondering what the relationship between sense making and in inverted commas, sense making in terms of grammatical, correctness, or in terms of, just the sequence or linearity of words, putting them together. And because I feel like your stuff kind of smashes words together that are really in strange ways that kind of refract then, a new meaning that comes out of it. I was wondering what your kind of relationship to that was.
Well, the sense making is a superimposition to me. I mean, I've had no use for it ever since the beginning. This is one of my struggles with linearity. I've never had a completely linear mind. So it's always been a circular reality. So when I started to write, I felt very at home. I feel very at home when I'm writing because of the fact that my mind is spinning and I'm not thinking about what's right or what's correct or what's incorrect. Yeah. As we started out the conversation with Booker Little about so-called wrong notes, the wider your mind gets, the more you can include rather than exclude.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about right or not right. It's a limiting conundrum for the mind, and it reduces it. I can see what Bernadette is saying is she wants to be open. She wants to let more energy into her work, which is just as great as it is. But her intelligence is understanding that limitation.
Yeah.
So therefore, the mind picks up these currents, these inner subtle currents about what should be. The poet understands these subtle currents of the mind, and as Baraka says, the sensitive collect and carry. Sensitive mind collects and carries the race, the human race. So he's like the miner. He's like the poet is kind of like the miner or the astronomer or the great scientist that understands that there's snow on the roof. The roof is about to collapse. One should get out. Here's a warning. Get out, get out, get out. Not because he's personally saying that, because he's talking about collective survival. And I think that like Greta Thunberg and other people are talking about collective survival rather than ideology. Mm. And I think the thinkers are more concerned less with individual effort than with collective effort this time.
I think that's a beautiful place to end it, honestly. Will, thank you so much for joining me today. Really, really can't thank you enough, man.
Thank you so much for putting up with the process of getting this together. And we'll talk soon.
You've been listening to Time Lost, a podcast by Purdue. You can find more information about the episode and our guest on our website, purdue.nl. This podcast was created with the support of the Amsterdam Fund for the Arts and the Dutch Foundation for Literature. Thanks for listening, and until the next Time Lost.